You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate. Our genetic makeup can explain our eye color, our height, and our predisposition to certain diseases. But a newer field of study called epigenetics is showing how the expression of those genes changes throughout our lives to help us meet the challenges of our environment, respond to our diet, and navigate the world around us. Joining me now to explain is Dr. Sharon Moalem. His latest book is called Inheritance: How Our Genes Change Our Lives and Our Lives Change Our Genes. It's published by Grand Central Publishing, and I'm pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Hi there.
Now, this book changes everything, because in our high school biology class, most of us were taught that genetics were something that were, you know, set at birth and determined everything from hair color and whether you can roll your tongue to your predisposition to certain illnesses and health conditions. Was that wrong, or is it just much more complicated than that?
Well, I think ultimately it's wrong, because what we're discovering is that actually no matter what we inherit, we have the ability to change our genetic destiny. And for example, we're seeing this every day now, and it sounds almost like science fiction, but if you find, for example, that you've inherited a BRCA1 mutation that predisposes you to cancer, just like Angelina Jolie, then you can go and take action and preemptively either get better screening or remove whatever can become cancerous in the future and become something called a previver. And now this has never been kind of an option before for anyone. You'd kind of have to wait to get sick. And so there's now thousands strong, there's these group of previvers who are now really kind of challenging what we thought about genetics.
Right. Although that's screening your genes and taking preventive action, but that isn't doing anything to actually change your genes. And your book is suggesting, at least in the subtitle of the book, that our behavior may actually be changing our genes as well. How does that mechanism work?
Well, it's fascinating, because it turns out, so genes on their own really don't do much. It's our lives that call on them for expression. And so if you take, say, identical twins who are born with exactly the same genome, over time, depending on their behaviors, on the environment that they're in, different genes get turned on and off. That this field is, as you mentioned earlier, called epigenetics. And what we're understanding from this field is that some of these changes can also then become inherited. So if one, say, individual experiences one thing in one generation, the pattern in which the genes are then turned off and on can be passed down to the next generation. And for example, we see this in many animal models where, so you take a mouse and you torment it by removing it from its mother for about an hour a day, and you do this for about a week. And what you find is that mouse grows up to be skittish, which isn't surprising. You've, caused post-traumatic stress disorder, essentially, the mouse version of it. The part that was really shocking to researchers was that the next generation, so when that mouse kind of grows up and impregnates a female and doesn't really contact the babies as they grow up, but they all then, the next generation behaves exactly like dad, as if they were traumatized. And when you look at their genes, the genes are the same, but the pattern in which they've inherited, the off-on pattern, is different, is like dad's. And so in that way, trauma can actually be inherited.
Well, I don't remember much from high school biology, but one thing I do remember was that before there was Charles Darwin, there was this guy named Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, and we would hear about Lamarckian evolution, and his whole theory was that if something happened to an animal, then that trait would get passed on to the next generation. And Darwin kind of came in and said, no, that's all nonsense. Here's how it works. Genes undergo mutations, and those genes then get passed on. But did Lamarck maybe have a point after all?
He did, and it's actually it's a combination of both, kind of just like that the subtitle for the book. So you inherit specific then genes that can give you specific traits, but then what you experience in your lifetime can then alter through genetic expression those traits.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, and I am talking to Dr. Sharon Moalem. His latest book is called Inheritance: How Our Genes Change Our Lives and Our Lives Change Our Genes. It's published by Grand Central Publishing. So this field of epigenetics, how was this first discovered? How did doctors and scientists discover this field?
It's an interesting question. So I think it wasn't even first seen in humans. Some of the first places that it was actually seen was in other species, such as plants. And the more kind of we started to look at other species, we discovered that it seems to be, you know, almost everywhere. And this makes sense because in a way it allows for inheriting what, you know, you experience in a certain environment to the next generation, because or certain species that experience it, the lifespan is not so long. So if you're trying to compete you're fighting bacteria that can evolve much faster than you can because their lifespan is much quicker, the turnaround time, this allows for somewhat flexibility, with what you inherit. And again, this is what we see with identical twins, monozygotic twins, who come into this world with the same kind of genetic package, but they don't always have very identical lives, or even they don't develop the same diseases. So what they experience in their environment then changes the genetic expression.
Now, you say that you start examining a patient by looking at his arm and how he flexes his elbow and his palm.
Right.
What can you learn about someone by doing that?
Well, I'm looking at you right now. So there's a lot of information that we have in our faces. Faces are actually very difficult biologically to put together. It starts out with five pieces of silly putty that need to kind of come together at just the right time and just the right amount and fuse together. And if something goes wrong, either in the environment of that developing fetus or in the genes that they inherit, you can see little telltale signs. So, for example, if a child was exposed to alcohol while they were in the womb, then there'll be little features that you can see. So if you look between the upper lip and the nose and it's a little more smooth, that's one feature then that can kind of signal that maybe that person was exposed to alcohol while their mother was pregnant.
And will that signify other problems down the pike for that person? Or
yeah, it may. And so looking at these different clues can then help you diagnostically, you know, figure out what genetic condition a person might have. And so what I've actually tried to develop over time is an application, a mobile app that then can just screen people for different conditions that then doctors can follow up on, because there's not a lot of people getting the type of medical training. And the field is called dysmorphology, to look at just faces and hands and then come up with a medical diagnosis.
You say that the spacing between our eyes can signal more than 400 genetic conditions. So can you look at somebody and start making some guesses about the conditions that they might have based on that?
Yeah. And I mean, eyes are a really good place to start. And if the eyes are too close together, that sometimes, for example, that could signal that something in brain development didn't happen properly. And that's why, you know, you end up with eyes that are too close together. And so that's a starting point. And when you look at someone, usually three kind of abnormality, if a person has about three abnormalities, that usually buys them a referral to a geneticist to be further investigated. And it might be just, you know, simple things like a crooked pinky that, you know, we call the fancy name clinodactyly, or any other kind of fused toes. So if you have webbed toes, but on their own, you know, we consider them normal variants. But when you kind of package them together, it can lead you to a new genetic diagnosis.
So is genetic diagnosis today a combination of these low-tech techniques, like looking at someone's face or their arms, and then high-tech tests like DNA sequencing? Is it a combination of these two?
Yeah, it's exactly those two. And, the other kind of place that we start is a family history. So drawing out a family tree to figure out what your relatives may have passed away from, what medical conditions they have, can give you a good idea of what you're at risk for. And then if you want to kind of confirm that suspicion, you follow up with DNA testing.
Now, you have a nice simile in the book. You say that our genes are like a musical score that can be played and interpreted so differently by different musicians or different instruments. What do you mean by that?
So it comes back to that idea, that wonderful idea of genetic expression.
Expression,
yeah.
Right.
And so for example, I'm sitting here in the studio having coffee. And so in coffee, there's caffeine that's broken down by a specific enzyme. If you know any smokers and you wonder why people who smoke tobacco can drink much more coffee and the caffeine doesn't seem to bother them, the cigarette smoke turns on the gene that also breaks down caffeine. And so smoking actually allows them to have more coffee. Now, I'm not telling anyone to start smoking so they can enjoy coffee late at night. But it's just that idea of expression. You know, you start out with the same genes, but the things you experience in the environment can change the way the genes come on and off.
Explain that concept of genes switching on and off, because that's not something we think about. We think of having genes and having traits, but what is the biological or cellular Sure. process by which that works?
Well, if you think about it, DNA on its own really doesn't do much, and that's why it's actually such a good way to store information, because it's just kind of, you know, sits there on its own in the cell. But depending upon what you need in which place in the body, you then access the DNA, and from that you can, say, make a functional machine that's a protein or an enzyme that can, you know, say, break down protein and help you digest your food. And so when the body needs more of that, it can then call up through DNA, through genetic expression, can go back to that gene and use that as a template to make more of a protein machine. And so when we speak about epigenetics, what epigenetics does is it could either make those DNA plans to make the machines less accessible, which is what you want to do in certain parts of the body. You know, you don't want an enzyme that helps you to break down your steak active in your eye, because it would auto-digest your eye, which isn't a good
thing.
That's
really gross, but thank you anyway.
Monday morning humor. And so through epigenetics, it's one way then to turn off the genes that you don't need in different parts of the body to keep them from being used. And when you develop cancer, for example, that whole process gets dysregulated. And so cancer cells that want to grow freely, they sometimes need genes for growth. And what they do is then they co-opt that epigenetic system and turn on genes that were actually turned off to keep the cells kind of quiet on their own, just doing their own thing.
Is this the process called methylation? Is that the process of turning genes on and off?
Yeah, that's one of the processes that you can get that epigenetics can work. And what methylation is, imagine, you know, say you have your DNA as a blueprint being stretched out. A methyl group is just like a chemical tag then that can come in and make that DNA or that blueprint less accessible to the cell's machinery. So even though you have the blueprint to make your protein machines, if they've been methylated or turned off, they're not accessible. It's as if they're not there in the cell.
You mentioned cancer. If we understand better how this process of turning genes on and off works, is that potentially a key to keeping cancer from spreading or keeping cancer from taking over our bodies?
That's a great question. And actually, there's been a lot of advances in the field looking at making drugs that can take advantage of turning off and on genes. So if you have a gene that's involved in growth, for example, then turning it off would then stop the cancer from being able to keep growing and spreading. The problem is that a lot of the drugs that we have so far that target this system have not been specific enough to the cancer itself. And then so the risk of side effects, of course, are a bit great. But as science progresses and our knowledge increases regarding the way the system works, there's a lot of hope that we'll have a lot of new drugs in these classes.
I'm speaking with Dr. Sharon Moalem about his latest book called Inheritance, How Our Genes Change Our Lives and Our Lives Change Our Genes. It's published by Grand Central Publishing, and we'll be back with more after a break. I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. Well, nature versus nurture has been one of those age-old debates, and now I'm finding out that it may be even more complicated than I thought. I'm speaking today to Dr. Sharon Moalem, and his latest book is called Inheritance, How Our Genes Change Our Lives and Our Lives Change Our Genes. You know, Sharon, I was just listening to Leonard in Italy, and I'm sure he's eating a lot of good Italian food, and that made me question diet, our diet. Does that affect our genes and how they adapt?
Yeah, it definitely does. And again, it's that idea of, you know, it depends what you come into this world with. And it makes me think about one of the cases that I discuss in the book. And I call that patient in particular Jeff the Chef.
And so, tell us about him.
And so this was an individual who was about in his 30s. was, you know, looking, was about to get married, was trying to think about how he could, you know, live a bit of a healthier life, was eating a lot of steak, of course, loved steak and potatoes. And his fiance kept bugging him and saying, you know, you have heart disease in your family and everyone has high cholesterol. Maybe you should, you know, see a doctor and think about changing your diet, which he did. And so some of the suggestions for him was, you know, start cutting down some of those saturated fats and introduce more fruits and vegetables. And so he did. And over a couple of years, he reduced his cholesterol but was not feeling much better. And slowly really started deteriorating, went back for some more tests and, you know, came back with some liver abnormalities, which then led to an MRI, which then found liver cancer, which didn't really make sense. He wasn't really exposed to anything, you know, from the environment that should cause that. Didn't really have any of the hepatitis viruses that are known to be associated with liver cancer. But when we dove into his genome, what we found was that he had a mutation that caused a condition called hereditary fructose intolerance. And this isn't an allergy. This is actually you don't have the ability to break down fruit sugar. And then that can build up in your liver and then cause cancer. So he actually did what the doctor ordered, which was change his diet. But for him, really, an apple a day almost really put him away. Thankfully for him, he got surgery, got the liver cancer out, and now is back to more of a less of a diet that he had previously.
He went back to the steak eating lifestyle that was right. Providing him with such good health.
That's right. And so this idea that we all should be on one diet, that one diet works for everyone, doesn't really make a lot of sense because we're all coming and inheriting genes from people from very different parts of the world. Some of us can break down lactose into adulthood or, you know, not lactose intolerant. Or if your ancestors are from East Asia, for example, likelihood is you can't have lactose. And that depends what your ancestors were eating. And that's why there's really not one universal diet that works for everyone.
Well, you just destroyed an entire industry with this pronouncement because we're supposed to have these one-size-fit-all diets, and you're saying that doesn't work?
No, it doesn't work at all. And really, the only diet that does work is the diet for the individual. And it's because of the genes that you've inherited have created that, you know, specific needs that are just for you. And we actually face the same thing as physicians with medications. Many of the medications that we are prescribing, we're, you know, using it from numbers that have been derived from treating populations. We're not really treating an individual. And that's why if you go to your doctor and you're starting a new medication, you're likely going to be starting at a dose and then, you know, either they're going to change the dose or they'll change to another medication to see what works best. And a lot of that has to do with the genes you inherited.
Now, when you decide to have children, you might do some genetic screening to see how your genes work together and whether that would be a good idea to reproduce.
That's right.
But we don't do that routinely. We don't, for example, when we're about to embark on a diet, we don't right. have our doctor do some kind of look at our genome to decide what diet would work best. Do you see a future where that could become routine? If somebody goes into their annual checkup or to do a full physical, they might have their genes mapped in some way?
Yeah, it's very likely that that's the future that we're going to be seeing. And probably the first place is going to have to do with medications because thousands of people die every year in the U.S., because they're actually being given the right dose at the right time, but it just doesn't sit well with their genes. And so what we're discovering is that this new field of pharmacogenomics, pharmacogenetics, is allowing us to kind of tailor the right medication to the right person at the right time.
What are we learning about epigenetics and their impact on things like allergies, for example? Are we learning that this is also something that our genes turning on and off are impacting?
That's a great question. I think the field is really early right now. Allergies is one of those environmental situations that we're discovering that you can say develop over time, and even identical twins that have exactly the same genome don't always develop the same allergies. But we're not really clear how epigenetics are involved in that field.
You also write in the book about a rambunctious kid named Richard whose body was unable to process ammonia, and when he changed his diet, many of his behavior problems lessened. Tell me about that case, how you stumbled upon it.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's really fascinating. And so what we're discovering is that a lot of conditions that we're labeling as autism may actually have a metabolic origin, which means that the the child may have inherited, or the adult may have inherited, genes that predispose them to not be able to break down food in the right way. And some of the toxins then that build up can also build up in the brain or in different organs that then change that person's behavior. And as we're discovering by kind of searching through the genome of these patients, that many of these conditions then you can alter through diet. And so the one case that you bring up, Richard, in the book, for example, was a case he had a condition called OTC deficiency. And so for him, breaking down protein would result in too much ammonia. So ammonia builds up in the body, ammonia builds up in the brain. And at least for him, it was it kind of expressed itself as behavior problems. He had problems focusing. He was very hyper in school. And the family actually had a lot of trouble believing that he did have a genetic condition. But once he switched to a low protein diet, his behavior like radically changed. And so it was interesting, actually, when I got a letter back from his teacher, she thought that his parents actually put him on a medication. But for Richard, really, the medication was just a change in diet.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, and we're learning all about our genes today with Dr. Sharon Moalem. His latest book is called Inheritance: How Our Genes Change Our Lives and Our Lives Change Our Genes. It's published by Grand Central Publishing. Now, you write that even our bones change over the course of our lifetime. Is our skeleton constantly being broken down and rebuilt? And how often does that happen? I mean, is that a daily thing where we're just constantly undergoing this metamorphosis?
Yeah, it's completely constant. And even as you and I are sitting here, it's happening. And hopefully we're going to get out of our chairs at some point and stress our bones. So when our muscles pull on our bones, that's really a signal for them to be strengthened. And many people get into trouble when they're in bed for too long, because that way gravity really doesn't affect their bones. And the remodeling ends up kind of eating away at their bones and making them thinner. And one specific group has a lot of problems with this, and that's astronauts. Because when you go up into space, you don't really feel the same effects of gravity, and it'll takes its toll on your skeleton. And over time, actually really quickly, the bones start becoming osteoporotic. And so the treatment really for that, for those astronauts, is resistance exercises. And we can learn from that too, because this kind of use it or lose it mentality works in all our organs and all our body systems.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to my Lamarckian model,
sure.
Again, if we spend our lives developing really good bone strength and bone density through exercise, like those little mice you described
right.
at the beginning of our conversation, will that have any impact on, say we reproduce, will that have any impact on our children's genes?
It's a great question. At least for humans, it's really early for us to tell, because the field is so young, so we haven't really followed people out that far enough. But looking at animal models and seeing how, you know, just a small change in the diet, just like, say, giving mice folic acid, can completely change the next generation's predisposition. They can go from being born obese and at risk for diabetes to be thin and healthy.
Does the field of epigenetics put even more significance on what happens during pregnancy? Do we know yet if the experience of the mother during pregnancy in terms of stress or nutrition affects the baby's genetic makeup or its genetic expression?
It's a great question, and it's a kind of hot field now of research, because what we're discovering is that the time of fetal development, a lot of, you know, kind of interesting things get laid down for the future. And so what that child, that fetus, is as they're developing, is being exposed to, is then laying down a lot of the risk factors for later on in life. And coming back to that example of folic acid, you know, what we're seeing now, at least from in mice, is when you say give a vitamin to a mother while she's pregnant, it can have a big impact in the way genes are being turned off and on, and then that becomes inherited into the next generation.
One of the really interesting things about the book, I thought, was the stories that you tell about your patients. Do you learn the most about genes and epigenetics when we see what can go wrong with our genes? Is that usually the most instructive thing for you?
In some ways, because that's where the study of rare diseases is really a gold mine for biological sciences and for medicine, because what we're discovering when you have, say, a rare condition and something goes wrong in the body, that can then, you can use that to model or look for a drug then that can treat millions of others. And the classic example is the class of drugs that are called statins that lower cholesterol. The basic discovery for these drugs was actually originated with a family who inherited genes that resulted in them having high cholesterol and heart attacks very early on in life. And so by studying the rare, that you can use that then to kind of tailor back and inform the common. And when we say rare, actually rare diseases are more common than all the cancers put together in America. It's thought that more than 30 million Americans are walking around today with a rare disease, and actually most of them don't even know it.
Hmm. Good, something else to worry about. Thank you for that.
Like I said, Monday morning.
Can we talk about bees for a minute? Because you talk about bees in the book. It's very interesting. You write about the differences between queen bees and worker bees. Aren't they the same bees on the genetic level? What happens to make one a queen and one a worker?
And so to me, this is one of the best examples, beautiful examples of how epigenetics works. So worker bees are actually females. And the only difference between them and a queen is that the queens receive a little more royal jelly during the time of their development.
Mm-hmm.
And that completely changed their biology, because worker bees can only sting once. And then they die, and then they can't also they can't lay eggs that that are fertile, so or that are other workers. And so to essentially create a queen, all it is a little more royal jelly. And
what is royal jelly exactly?
So royal jelly is almost, if you can imagine, like a souped up honey. And so it's produced by the glands essentially in the workers, and then fed to a developing pupa. And that's what turns into a queen. And so if the developing kind of, you want to call it baby bee, gets cut off of royal jelly really early, then it develops into a worker, which is a regular female. If that baby keeps getting that special royal jelly, then a queen eventually emerges, which physiologically is completely different than a worker. She's larger, she can lay eggs, she can sting multiple times, and she can challenge the existing queen to reign the hive.
So is the analogy here for humans that there are things that we could do in utero or in a mother's nutrition that could make her offspring maybe not queen bee, but healthy and thriving and smart and all those things that we look for in children or hope for in our children?
Most definitely. And that's kind of like the hope that I've tried to infuse out throughout the book, is that regardless of what you've inherited genetically, it's really how you, you know, live your life. And if you choose then to become empowered with what you have, then you can kind of, either through diet and exercise, really kind of capitalize and stay healthy.
In this field, it seems so revolutionary what you're talking about, and it seems like the implications could be massive. Is there a problem in setting people's expectations too high, that we live in a culture of self-improvement already, where
right.
people think that going to the gym will make them better, or they'll become more attractive and they can listen to tapes that will make them have better memories and things like
sure.
that. Is there danger in the field of epigenetics creating ridiculously high expectations for how superhuman we can become?
Well, I think we're starting at such a level of hopelessness when it comes to genetics.
You know, so the bar is low right now.
The bar is very low. And, you know, when you ask most people on the street, and actually most physicians as well, the concept right now is you're kind of stuck with what you've inherited. And and if, you know, your father, your grandfather suffered from heart disease, you're just as likely. But really, we're going to be one of the first generations that can make and change our genetic destiny, just like the becoming a previvor, which is, you know, discovering you have a predisposition to cancer and taking action.
So should we all get our genome sequenced? Is that something we should be doing, or are there some people who should be doing it more than others?
It's a great question. I think more people should be getting their genome sequenced than they are right now. The biggest problem is, and people are not aware of this, is that there's no real good federal protection against genetics discrimination when it comes to life insurance and disability. And so if you uncover that, say, you inherited a mutation in your BRCA1 mutation gene and you're greater at risk for developing cancer, an insurance company can then turn around and either not give you insurance or offer you at a rate that doesn't make any financial sense when it comes to life insurance and disability. And so until these laws are really in place to protect the individual, I'd really kind of highly suggest people to either think twice or to get genetic testing done anonymously.
As someone who is living this field every day, do you feel that we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg, or how far along are we into understanding epigenetics? Are you going to write another book in 10 years that refutes everything in this book, or what's your feeling? You must be excited.
Right. Oh, no. I am really excited because I think, you know, even just a few years ago when I was going through medical school, epigenetics wasn't even covered. And even genetics, we only had, maybe a few hours during 1 week out of the 4 years of medical school training. And so the field is so rapidly changing, especially with the drop in cost for testing. It cost 15 years ago $1 billion to sequence someone's genome, and now we're down to just a few thousand dollars. So the hope is that the more information we get, the more we'll be able to predict and the more we'll be able to intervene.
I've been speaking with Dr. Sharon Moalem about his latest book called Inheritance, How Our Genes Change Our Lives and Our Lives Change Our Genes. Interesting stuff. It's published by Grand Central Publishing. And Dr. Moalem, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.